Thank you very much for these words. I'm glad to be here again. For me, it's always an important moment to come to Einsiedeln once a year. And what is also important to get up here, because it takes a while to get to Einsiedeln with the train. So it's like the way to get, you know, a path to be here in a different realm, which has another quality from the hecticness or the life more in the cities. I'm very glad to be here. I'll talk about dreams today. And the title of my lecture is Dreams, Constant Irritant or Valuable Inner Voice. I first want to give us a kind of overview of what I want to say. I want to say what is actually the gist of my thoughts. And then I start talking. I thought I would probably we have a break, don't we?
Yes, please.
In about an hour.
About
10:30. 10:30. So we'll have a break there and then may continue, and then I thought we have a discussion. What I want to say is, I want to say something on actually how are dreams treated today? What is the attitude, the general attitude towards dreams? So in my first part, I'll say something about how the zeitgeist, or how we are now actually valuing or not valuing dreams. So that would be the first part. Then I want to say something about our general attitude towards human beings, or towards soul, towards psyche. So there I want to say something about our tendency, or the tendency nowadays to have everything under control, which is said something about that, and our difficulties to having empty spaces, empty rooms, which are not predefined. That will be the second part, because I think that's one of the tendencies, or maybe a deficiency also in the society, or part of the zeitgeist. That would be the second part, and I think this is interconnected to the way we approach dreams. And then at the end, I want to briefly say something about how shall we approach dreams? What are dreams? I believe dreams are a valuable resource. I believe dreams are very important, but we have a tendency to fence ourselves off from dreams, also by using techniques of dream interpretation. So that will be the second part. So, to the first part, human beings dream. We all have, when we sleep, we're not just unconscious, but something happens to us, and then when we wake up, we remember images, we remember stories, we remember pictures of something which was in our heads. So dreams is something which comes always from another realm, another area. We can't take our video camera or iPhone with us and make pictures of what we've dreamt. So dreaming is always something which dreams always have their value in reflection, always have their value when we look back on the way we think things might have happened. This is very important if we consider or look at the meaning of dreams. If you look at the contents of dreams, they vary. And I give you three examples of dreams of so-called normal people, average life, who had certain dreams. One dream, the first dream, is of someone who was working at a company, and she had a lot to do, and she dreamt that she went into that company, and she and her boss were sitting there, and people came in, customers came in, and they all had different dresses. Everyone was clothed differently. So one was clothed with sort of a lot of very colorful. Someone else was dressed badly. So there was a various different way people were dressed. They all came in and they had distinct demands. They wanted something very special. They said, I want this and that. And she and her colleague, they got more and more confused. You know. Then suddenly a very fat man enters. Fat man with a huge stomach, with a huge belly. He enters and he somehow dominates the scene. After this, it's decided, and one doesn't know exactly why, that one changes floors. So they all move to another floor, and in this other floor, they would make some investigation, some kind of assessment. And the assessment was made by, I don't know what exactly the English word is, by splashing water on everyone from a fountain. So her colleague went there, and she had to go there and splash water, so take water and sort of press on the, how do you call it?
Spray,
yes, spray waters on everyone, so like children do. That was the assessment she did. And she was a bit confused, said, why do I have to do this? This seems a bit absurd. And then her colleague came, put her hand on her shoulder, said, everything will be all right. So that's a dream. That's a dream where we can say normal. A dream which the dreamer thought, I can understand it more or less. Oh, yeah, I have a lot of stress in my work, yes, of course, and we have a good relationship, we help each other. So the dreamer who had this dream thought, recollected, made some recollections of the dream, but I think at 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, she had forgotten about the dreams again. So it was just some ideas. Oh, yeah, I see, I had a lot of stress. Oh, good colleague, my colleagues, we worked together. A lot of the elements were not reflected by her. Why the fat man? Why did the fat man come in? Why the different clothing? That's something she could understand. Different type of people, difficult to say, people are always presenting themselves in their persona, in the way their appearance is. So we have to deal with people in their appearance. Maybe we have to irritate them, get something out of them. Maybe we have to do... So she could understand this particular dream, but she only understood elements. That's one example. Now another example, perhaps a bit stranger, of a man, 42, and he dreamt he's a teacher. He lived a normal life somewhere outside of Zurich, had a family, and a rather peaceful life, not a lot of stress. You know, had a difficult class sometimes, but you know, average work. And then at the night he dreamt that he was fighting. He was in a other country fighting. And he was in a country which was completely corrupt. The government was completely corrupt. And then he met a group of representatives of that government, and he wanted to cooperate with them, talk with him about, you know, the situation in the country. But as she talked to these representatives, it was in a hotel, sort of a simple hotel, he realized they're also corrupt. So it got more and more difficult. Instead of implementing, enforcing law and order, these representatives of the government he was in this strange country, were also corrupt. They were corrupt because they had been bribed. They had been given a lot of monies. So he was actually in a difficult... He thought, these are the men who should help me fight, you know, do an anti-corruption campaign. But in reality, they're all bribed anyway, so I can't... And he realizes, I have to watch out. I have to be aware. And then at the appropriate moment, he escapes the restaurant or the hotel. And he walks towards the border of Mexico. Now this is a man living outside of the village in Zurich, and he dreams walking to the border of Mexico. And he crosses the border to Mexico, and then there's a long, big street, and in the street, a limousine, like a stretch limousine appears, drives towards him. He goes to the limousine, and the driver comes out, opens the door, and then he realizes inside the door it's full of shit. The whole content of the limousine is full of shit. And he's a bit confused and says, what is happening? And then suddenly a donkey comes and says, oh, I was looking for my shit. Where is my shit? And gets into the limo. Now, as I told you, this is a normal, decent family father outside living in the suburbs of Zurich, and he has a dream like that. Obviously, no, he couldn't understand it at all. It didn't make any sense because he's not been to Mexico and he doesn't deal with corruption. So he's completely has no explanation. Why does he have this special dream? Why? He shrugged the dream off and said, well, I had this crazy dream. I don't know. Stupid dream is strange. So that's it. And he left it. He didn't actually deal with it because it was too much of an irritation. It was too much of something which didn't fit the usual patterns of his life. It just did not. There's no place for a story like this. It doesn't fit into the context of what he's doing. And this is, of course, something many people experience. So we don't have dreams. The dreams we have are not just the first category, where we somehow can derive something, some kind of meaning, some kind of connection. So a lot of people have dreams, or we all have dreams, which are irritant, which are just bizarre, which are crazy. Either we consider ourselves crazy or so, or else we just forget about the dreams and put them away. And that's actually what we usually do. Maybe not us, because we're more, but that's what usually people do. They just forget about them. They forget about these crazy dreams. But we have other dreams also. And a lot of dreams have, of course, scenes which may be to have difficulty accepting. Like someone else told me, he went to a new job, had a new job, and the first time at his new job, they had a board meeting. Everyone, not the staff meeting, everyone was there in a circle, and then they said, well, we have to get to meet each other, we have to get to know each other, we make a personal encounter, and we thought we'd make a psychological exercise, touch me feeling exercise. So sitting there, I said, okay, this is that's a way of another way of introducing new staff. And then at the exercise, they had to move up and look at each other, and then suddenly a woman approaches him and comes towards him, kisses him, and then they make love just in front of everyone else. And he has this tremendous sensuous dream of making love, a very sensuous dream in front of everyone else. Of course, it's, in reality, it didn't turn out that way, you know, when he started his new job. But we also have dreams which somehow have contents which we could sort of imagine, maybe, or maybe even dream of, but of course outlandish, it's completely beyond whatever we would do. So the dreams we remember, and we can only remember dreams, we haven't got dreams, we only remember them. The dreams we remember have various qualities. And as you know, maybe there's been a lot of attempts to categorize the different dreams. There's been a lot of attempts to somehow put them into boxes. Maybe this is this type of dream, this type of dream, this type of dream. But which is difficult, because it's difficult to categorize dreams. Usually the banal dreams, the dreams which are, or the simpler dreams, these are the ones we can usually derive something from. But the majority of the dreams are understandable, I think. The majority of dreams don't really make a sense immediately if we really look at them. Now, dreaming, the phenomena human beings have, you know, human beings can remember, and one says recollection is one of the basic qualities of human beings. Human beings don't just live in a particular moment, but they can then think back of what they have experienced. And when they think of something they experience, that's when things usually make sense, or that's when we try to make of things sense. So our basic capacity is actually to draw a sense out of what has happened to us. Usually it doesn't happen at the actual moment. So many times we don't realize what is happening at a specific moment. We realize it in the reflection. I think that's a tendency where we can look at things in depth. I thought of this 3 days ago when I passed Central, a place in the town of Zurich, and as I passed Central, I remembered a picture, a photograph I saw of that particular area, which was taken more than 100 years ago. And it was very interesting to see this place, Central, it's in the center of Zurich, and suddenly this image comes up from 100 years ago. And this image from 100 years ago, it was just a photograph, showed two women talking to each other, showed a child playing in the background, showed someone in the tram, you know, with a uniform, with a hat. So this, when you looked at this image, it revealed a lot. It revealed a lot about the times. It revealed a lot about the role of women. It revealed a lot about authorities with a hat. It revealed a lot of the superficial things like technical things, but if you saw just fixed put, it actually gave you some in-depth view of the society more than 100 years ago. You could read a lot out of it, this particular image. But the moment I just passed Central, it was difficult to do. And I couldn't go there and say, okay, let's study this. So everything, it was in movement. Everything was sort of going to and fro. So I couldn't actually, it was very difficult to grasp the same meaning when you really live it. It's sometimes easier when you do it in reflection, easier when you look back at something, easier when you memorize things, or when memory comes in. This is something I think one has to realize when one approaches dreams, that we tend to live in the here and now, but in the here and now, often, in-depth thinking is a bit difficult. In-depth thinking is not possible. It's something we do in retrospect. So I think reflection, time for reflection, is very important in order maybe to give ourselves to see the sense of something, maybe to see connections, maybe see, so that's it. Now, this is something, of course, which is connected with dreams. As I said, dreams is something we remember. Dreams is something we always remember in retrospect. So as dreams, we don't really experience at the particular moment. You can't make notes when you're in a dream. You can't take a photograph. You have to remember the dream afterwards. Then you might keep the image or you might lose the image. And the fact that we dream, I think, has to do with a sort of a basic quality or a basic feature of human beings. We produce images, memories of something every night. And I think it's a tremendous asset. It's something, a tremendous quality. But, as you know, the way we deal with irritations, or the way we deal with these paradigms, or the way we deal with these amplifications, varies a lot. And if you look at times, you see from culture to culture has a different approach to this basic fact that we can dream, that we produce some kind of stories or produce some kind of image every night which we remember afterwards. And the approach or the attitude is different. When you look at it historically, I mean, maybe Asclepius, I think, is something you might know. You know, the way in Epidaurus, I think it's very important to see that the way actually medicine is based, if you look at the sign for medicine, you know, you see the Asclepius, you see this snake. Medicine is based actually on the Asclepius, on Epidaurus, where it had a big temple. And as you know, in Greece, when someone was sick, had an ailment, he used to go to the Epidaurus, that kind of not an island, it was sort of a peninsula, something like that, went there. And in the big temple, big pillars, and it was up on a mountain, the people would go in there, and what they would do in the Epidaurus is just sleep. They slept there. Imagine all the snoring, everybody coming in and just sleeping there. So they all slept there, and then when they woke up, you know, they tried to remember what did they dream, and then there were a lot of people around, interpreters, and they tried to find an ailment, a remedy for the sickness according to what they dreamt. So that was apparently there could be very banal things like, okay, you have to go and swim a little bit in the sea, just dive in, swim around a little bit, and maybe it would get a bit better. But some things were very concrete, so the remedies were actually based on what they dreamt, what one dreamed. And of course, one could say now, and maybe a lot of things would say, well, this is just folkloristic, they didn't know anything about medicine. These were the days before medicine was really developed. But I think there's actually more to this way. As Bleuler once said, Bleuler, I think, when he would talk to patients, and he would always ask them also what dream they had. And he said, when they tell me the dreams, I can diagnose also a lot of what is going on. So he sees someone who used that. I knew another doctor who also did that. He said, dreams are also important for me because somehow there's an indication. There seems to be some connection between what we dream, between what is going on in our heads, and the way we feel and the way we are. So there was one example where dreams were used as an ailment, and medicine actually started that way. But it was important also, you had to go somewhere, you had to travel, you had to go to the distinct realm. You had to sort of find the right locus, the right place, which had a certain quality where you could dream. But interesting enough, dreams were also important in very worldly professions. One tends to forget that Alexander the Great, who was a warrior, tremendous warrior, he sort of had his whole empire. I think he went practically to Afghanistan and India and conquered one city after the other. And he had many experts, sort of advisors among his crew. Who always, before he would make a decision, he would ask his advisor, shall I really attack? Do we have enough food? Do we have a lot of logistics? How is it with armament? That's how he would discuss. But what is interesting, and a lot of people don't realize, he also had a dream interpreter. So one of his, he asked dream interpreters also, say, yeah, we have enough food, okay? How is it with the power? How's the weather? And so, okay. By the way, I had this dream. Can I tell you the dream? Maybe this has an importance. And this advisor would then tell him, well, your dream tells me this. No, maybe not. Apparently, the town of Tyros, which is in Turkey, was when he passed Tyros, they had made a lot of resistance. They wouldn't let to be. They didn't want to be conquered, the people of Tyros. And Alexander had other ideas. He wanted to move on. He wanted to move on to Iran and to India. So he was pressed for time. He said, I can't wait 2 or 3 months. This is going too long. So he's contemplating of just leaving the town because his empire had pockets which weren't conquered. It wasn't completely controlled. So I thought, let's just leave them. And then he had a dream of satyrs dancing around the fire laughing. And he told that dream to his dream interpreter, and they said, well, they'll be laughing at you, and so, and then he decided to conquer the town and called it Tyros, according to his dream. So, you see, in other professions, and if you see it, it's Alexander, I think, is a very worldly, I want to call it a doer in some way, and but still, he appreciated dreams, he included dreams, he included the capacity, and it was for him a major point of reference when he made a decision. Also, what one tends to forget, in a Senate, in a Senate, you had duties as a citizen. When you were a Roman citizen, you had certain duties for the state. And these duties were compulsory, something which was important when you were a member of the Senate, or when you were a Roman citizen. And one of the duties you had was that if you had a dream which might be important for the state, you had to go to the Senate and inform the Senate about your dream. And that was one of the duties one had. So you had to go in and said, this night I had the dream about Rome, this happened, You had to inform your colleague, and it was considered compulsory. Not something notes added. As a serious citizen, you had to. Now, just imagine how this would be today. In Switzerland, if someone would come and say, well, I had a dream about Switzerland, everybody would laugh. Or I don't know how, in the United States, in the House of Representatives, I had a dream this night about it. But is it interesting that Rome, being one of the big empires, I think one of the biggest empires, and in many ways very, very successful, they actually considered the inclusions of dreams as something very valuable, something decisive, something which was important when you made decisions, when you ruled. So there you have another example where actually dreams were included, dreams were given a certain purpose, dreams were given a certain function. Of course, there's other elements where dreams also play an important role. One element is Omaha, of course. In Omaha, dreams were also very important, of course, especially for adolescents when they got older. And I think as children and adolescent psychologists, it's very interesting how they dealt with the transition from childhood to adulthood. in our country or so, usually there's a lot of confusion, there's a lot of searching, there's a lot of sort of indignation, there's a lot of annoyance, drug also. In Switzerland nowadays, a lot of the problem of alcoholism has started because it became fashionable for 13, 14-year-olds to drink a lot of alcohol before they go out and party, because it's forbidden for them to buy alcohol. So what they do now, they get drunk before, and then they start partying, which actually worsens the situation. But it's interesting to see the insistence these young people have on trying to get in other states of mind, trying to sort of transgress consciousness, trying to find other realms. There seems to be like a persistence in that. They don't want to sort of give that up. That's something they want to keep. Now, if you see, and I think this is something typical of that age group. That age group wants to tune in, connect, sort of in other realms. Doesn't just want to experience, doesn't just want to learn, get more competences, get more knowledgeable, but they also want to find out what are the different qualities of we have as a human beings. How can we fantasize? How can we imagine? Now, how did the Omaha, the Sioux, deal with it? They, someone reached puberty, got 13, 14, and had certain dreams, and it was usually an indication he had to go to the Wakonda, sort of the not the medicine man, he was sort of the one responsible for dealing with dreams. He had to go to him, and he would talk to him about his dreams. He said, oh, I see, your dreams are changing. Your dreams have another quality. They're not the same as before when you were a child. Somehow you seem to move on. And then he would start a discussion on the dreams, just on the dreams. And then depending on the dreams, he would even tell him, well, now it's time you leave the village. You leave and you kind of cry for a vision. You go outside and you search for a hill, you search for a mountain somewhere, and there you have to stay there and not sleep. You know, stay awake and try to get a vision, a dream, you know, get more in contact. And then you come back and we talk about what you've dreamt. And depending on what you've dreamt, you can come back to the village and then you'll be assigned or to the respective brotherhood. You know, so there are a lot of brotherhoods, a lot of societies within one society. And then we discuss what kind of function you'll make, what kind of job you'll have. So it was interesting, the way actually the transgression, so from childhood to adulthood, was done over dreaming. Dreaming was a very important, including the dreams. And I think that's an ingenious way of doing it, because it actually respected the urge or the need of young people wanting to explore themselves, not just in the outside, but also in the inside. Also want to exploring themselves in depth. So they don't usually, and I think this is one of the fallacies we have in adolescent psychology, child adolescent psychology, usually in that age when one doesn't just want to be extroverted, have fun, party, travel around. One also wants to go find out what is going inside, you know, how we function as human beings. And Omaha, I think they have created a ritual, have created a means of actually coming from one phase to the other. So that's another example where dreams have been included. Dreams have given a ritual and have given a certain purpose. And of course, what is one culture which is quoted again and again, and I think is also very interesting, is of course the Aborigines. As you know, the Aborigines, they value dreams a lot. And I think they had a very interesting notion about dreams. As I said, dreams, that is when the gods talk to us. The gods talk to us in the dreams. And when we dream, we go back to dream time, which was a time before actually human beings came on earth. So it was like a present. They had to be grateful when they had dreams. And I think it's great. They also said, when you're tired, maybe a god wants to call you. So you immediately have to try to sleep in order to catch the dream which might be approaching. I think this is something which helps me a lot, because when I'm tired, I always try to sleep, and irrespective of what I'm doing, Of course, I can't do it during a session or so. I'm going to sleep now. But to look at tiredness not as a fault, not as something one has to fight, that's the hero attitude, oh, I can't afford it, but just to let go, to dive into it and say, what kind of quality comes to me? And in all my offices, I have kind of a couch or a bed, and I could do allow myself that if I'm also overworked. I said, okay, 15 minutes, I just lie down and I rest, and maybe I have a dream. Maybe not. Sometimes I don't really have a dream. So I think this is something which one can learn from the culture of the Aborigines, that tiredness might lead to something, to drowsiness, and maybe, if you're lucky, you have a dream. So these are approaches, different approaches to dreams, and I think valuable, and it's always, you know, every culture thinks their position, their stance is the best, one is the most developed culture of all cultures. That's what all the cultures think. So I think instead of denigrating these rituals, we should perhaps try also to learn from these examples. Maybe they have something to tell us. Maybe what this way of approaching dreams is also something which is which can be helpful for us. As you know, the one who actually reintroduced dreams in sort of in the Western country, but it disappeared again, was of course Sigmund Freud. You know, psychoanalysis reintroduced dreams, but they talked about the unconscious. Unconscious was a very sly way of sort of trying to allow and to integrate dreams again. But it's interesting that he called it unconscious. There's a sort of a value judgment in consciousness is important, and then we have the unconscious. Actually, you could have given that a different name, not just unconscious. You could have called it, I don't know, the mysterious side of us, or sort of the hidden resources, anything, you know, but you got unconscious. You have the consciousness, that's what we actually base our life on, and then we have the unconscious. But through his dream interpretation technique, you know, suppression, symbolizing it, so the latent meaning and the manifest meaning, actually he somehow could make a bridge that for a certain while dreams were accepted again, for a certain while dreams actually were talked about again. But unfortunately, it got actually vilified or denigrated again. As you know, in psychology or sort of in education, when actually dream interpretation, the way it's done by psychoanalysis is considered something which is unserious, is actually unprofessional. It's something when I have some colleagues from university, they jump and they talk about psychoanalysis, they think they're very smart, and they say, well, you know what I did? I gave a dream, this experiment they made, they gave a dream to one analyst, and then they gave the same dream to another psychoanalyst, and the interpretation was completely different. That shows that it's rubbish, you know, obviously. And it's aggravating when you hear this, because it shows a complete, entire misunderstanding of dream interpretation, an entire misunderstanding of what dreams are. It shows that it's been sort of vilified. And this is in textbooks. You read this, what I'm saying. So in textbooks, average psychology students, all he hears about psychoanalysis is this sort of this way of describing it, which has actually nothing to do with the way actually dreams are looked at in psychoanalysis or so. So I want to now come to the second part. I want to say something now about what is the current attitude towards dreams. How do we deal? When I talk about we, I talk about the general attitude, you know, society attitude, sort of the general paradigms one refers to when one talks about dreams. I think generally one says the general attitude nowadays is dreams are unimportant, or people usually don't refer to dreams in everyday life. That if you want to function in everyday life, if you want to be successful, if you want to be considered serious, you certainly don't include dreams in your way of argument. You make yourself ridiculous. That's clear. Dreams are considered so-called, electronical sort of fuzzy, you know, something which happens to the brains. The brains are not quite out, completely out of order during the night, so there's some kind of last minute electronic ignitions, and that's all. So they don't make any sense. So that actually only sort of hardcore psychoanalysts, only people who are completely outdated, might put any value on dreams. I think that's an attitude we have nowadays, which I think is a bit sad. The thing is that actually the basic parameter, how we see each other, I think this contrasts to the Aborigines, to Omaha, to Alexander the Great, the basic paradigm we have now, we have to have things under control. And I think the control mania, or the control fallacy, that's something which is very strong, that we have to have, can have ourselves as human beings under control. This is something I see in many areas. One area I see it, of course, in education. In education, where people seriously believe that the best lesson they give at the school is the lesson which have been exactly planned ahead. So everything has been planned, and now, unfortunately, there are certain schools where they try to define lessons by 5 minutes episodes. So these 5 minutes, this will be said, afterwards 10 minutes, this. So it's complete control. So there's nothing, there's no flow, so everything has to be preconceived. So the same, of course, goes in other areas like economy. Economy had the great fallacy we could control everything, and as you know, it got completely out of control. In Europe, it's, the whole euro zone will collapse. But the basic idea, when you listen to the way what the arguments was, we can control this, we do this and this, and then this will happen. So control is the approach we have nowadays. We believe that the ego actually can be in charge. The same happened actually in the way we do research, the so-called evidence-based. I, for myself, what I'm doing nowadays, if someone lectures and says 3 times evidence-based, I stand up and go out. Because I think it has an attitude towards life, which usually, if someone says more than 3 times evidence-based, there's not a lot of imagination in his thoughts, usually. I mean, this may be... Because it's the belief that you really can also control it by everything you... every insight is only an insight when it's been in controllable, repeatable, controllable, and so on. Then actually it's only an idea you can talk about. So many things I would say now would be considered perhaps not evidence-based. But as you know, what evidence-based often produces is banalities. This is one I read a great announcement that found out people who laugh a lot are happier. Evidence-based. That's if you look at the journals or teachers which are enthusiastic about a job, their students have better grades. A lot of things which you find out, well, wait a minute, this is a bit bizarre, because it sort of puts us back in a way we can reflect on something. It puts us back on phase one. It gets so banal, you know. Is that if I talk loud, you might hear me better, you know, things like that. Everyone. So it's a disrespect for our thinking capabilities, or, as I said before, for our the possibilities, the potential of reflection. So it's actually disrespect for our potential of reflection. But this is an attitude. So now training programs are being done. Something I see in many areas, that training for our conflict management, it's bizarre in conflict management. One knows that conflicts happen because a lot of components, actually, in every situation, there's a lot of components which might be relevant for that particular situation. And so it's especially with conflicts which don't happen a lot. For instance, you get attacked on the street or so. It's impossible to identify all the components which might be important or which might influence that particular situation. In spite of that basic fact, training programs are being done in many areas where one reduces it to one or two. So, well, he calls me and he tries to attack me with a fist and I sort of push away his fist. When you look at the conflicts in reality, you see that every conflict is completely different. And my experience is that more intuitive faculties are usually more helpful than all this what has been done from training and control. This is a sort of a fallacy, an illusion. So that's something, control. Also, another fact is that we usually think the more you philosophize about life, the more you differentiate things, the more you look at the different aspects of something, the better. So the notion is, or an illusion is, that by thinking, by reflecting, we might also be more sort of successful in life and can get. But of course, as you know, this is not the case. In order to succeed in many areas, you have to reduce the phenomena. So intelligence defined as a possibility to reflect on something, to do in-depth reflection, to see different components. Intelligence is a hindrance. Intelligence is a burden. When you look at things too differentiated, you might not be able to function anymore. I remember someone who was a very successful businessman in India and China, and I talked to him about India. After having been in India, I was fascinated by the country, and I tried to engage in a conversation with him because he's been there many times, 10 times a year, and then I said something. He said, oh, well, you know, for me it's important not to see anything. Otherwise, I forget my goals. So I only have to think of my goals, of what I have to do. I'm not allowed to see anything. If I see anything, I get distracted and I get off track. And suddenly I start using my thinking capabilities on a detail. So I have to stay put. I have to stay focused. And I have to have my theory of what how things are functioning. He was a very intelligent man. I can't do philosophizing. That's not possible. Because that way I couldn't reach the goals. And this is an approach which is very common, that actually to function in a theater of life, to function actually and to be successful, you need to reduce your thinking capabilities. You need to reduce your perception. You need to be more, you're not allowed to be sensitive. If you're sensitive, you might get in trouble, you might get distracted. So you have to be unsensitive. I think this is what we generally have to view. So people who see too much, people who are too differentiated, they're losers, you know. So they have to. And this is how we function. So this is, I think, one paradigm, which was, of course, also influences our approach to dreams. Only crazy people deal with dreams. Also, one has to see the psychology of the self-image. We all have a self-image. We all have a view of who we are, a view of how we are, a view of what features, what qualities we've got. And the self-image is usually the basis of our decisions, usually the basis of the foundation of our thoughts. You know, if I would call it, well, so we have an extra this afternoon, so we go bungee jumping up in somewhere here in the Hochebrig. I personally wouldn't do it. Maybe you would do it. I don't know. Kay would do it, but I wouldn't do it because I think, well, it's, I don't know how if the length of this is really enough. So I would be hesitant. So it's my self-image which decides on which challenges I'll take. It's my self-image. And the self-image is considered actually usually subjectively as a mirror of our personality. It's usually considered the way we subjectively believe that the way we see ourselves is really the way we are. And we attribute certain features and certain qualities to. So we say, well, I think I'm someone who can listen. I think I'm someone who's tolerant. Maybe I've got also deficiencies. Sometimes I'm not very tolerant. Sometimes I get angry. So that's the image we have. And the self-image is, of course, I think, is always a function of the society we belong to. So we define ourselves the way the group of people we belong to wants us to be. we give ourselves the qualities which are important in the respective groups. So the way we see each other's, or the qualities we attribute to ourselves, actually are references to the groups we want to belong to. So like in the teacher's profession, of course, everybody loves children. But that's not, you have to say that. You said, well, I really like children. And everybody has to be able to relate. I communicate, that's actually one of my basic skills. You have to do it because it belongs to the teacher's profession. But in general, too, you have to somewhat define yourself according. And aspects which don't belong to the particular group you belong to or don't belong to the zeitgeist, these are the ones you have to exclude. Because if you include them, you might have difficulties with yourself, because your self-image doesn't suit what you actually would like to be. And you might have also difficulties getting accepted in a group you belong to. So there's a danger when people have this self-image of being rational beings, being able to decide, usually other aspects are excluded. And I think the view we always generate of ourselves as human beings is restricted, has to be restricted, because it belongs to, it's a way of belonging to a certain society. And this is something which is even gets stronger if we live in an extroverted society. We've just been talking about that. In a society where rehearsal is important, where to participate in a teatro del mundo is important, where somehow things, survival, having a position in the noise one makes with such society, where that is important, this gets even more important. It's something I can see, for instance, I often have to go on, and sometimes I have to go on discussions, political discussions, or discussions on television, and usually they're very boring, because the area that you can talk about is restricted. You realize you're only allowed to talk on these lines. And you realize when you give an answer, someone starts saying, well, what do you think of, say anything about violence? And then you couldn't say, well, I think there's a fascination of violence. Maybe we need violence. It doesn't go. You cut off immediately. So what is allowed to say, well, I think violence, of course, is a problem, and we have to abate the problem. So that's allowed. So you actually, we're living in a restricted code. When we move in the social arena, when we move around, we start, I mean, to put it a bit bluntly, we get a bit dumber in some ways. We see less, we perceive less. And this is something which happens to all of us, because we all want to participate in a society. We all want to be part of a group, unless we're a complete loner, but we're usually not loners. We might have a family where this functions. So as we want to be there, we also exclude other aspects of our psychology. So we have to realize we might sort of cling in, sort of participate in an ego culture where the ego is important and where consciousness but is important. But we have to realize that consciousness, or what we think of it is, in certain ways is a bit of a delusion. So the thoughts we give ourselves consciously, what we think the reasons are why we do something, or what we think our features is, usually not what really happens, or what the way we human beings are. Or in other words, we have another realm which is always with us, but in which we usually don't connect. Human beings function by selecting a separate world for them, a separate world where they can move, a smaller world, and there they participate in a theater, you know, doing their job, saying their things, making their statements, appropriate statement where one knows we get some kind of attention. That's how we actually function. But one has to realize from the point of view of psychology, this means excluding probably a lot. This means a reduction. And I think this is what the situation we are, or other, in other words, we naturally fence ourselves off from other insights. And of course, now perhaps we have to think of the concept of psyche, or the concept of soul. You know, the concept of soul, it's being discussed now, interestingly enough, again, in our culture. There's been a lecture series on soul, where certain people came and allowed themselves to use the term soul. So actually, if you think of how we perceive ourselves, you know, the basic paradigm is, well, it's just function, and the brain is somehow just here, but it's all materialistic. And so, but the basic concept of soul is then, of course, something which is very, which is not really included in that way in Teatro del Mundo. The soul, of course, has another dent. Soul is something, when you use that word, which has an indication of something which is continuously mysterious, which is not been able to be pinned down. If you look at the images of soul, there's all images which are a bit not fluffy, sort of flaky, you know, so you can't really, you have a butterfly maybe. Butterfly is an image for soul that flies around and it's nowhere. So it's here and nowhere. So that's what, and you can see that soul, you know, is something, I think, which this term, it's understandable that this term is excluded because the term doesn't fit into this control mania which got, because it's somehow something which implements an energy, which implements a realm which is not controllable, which might have an influence, which might be here, which might not be here, which might touch us, which might not touch us, which maybe is somewhere, maybe not. So which leaves more question marks than answers. And I think the concept of soul, which I think is important, is ingenious for human beings to think of soul, to think they will have a soul. The concept of soul doesn't have any space, actually, in this concept of control mania or egomania. And this, of course, leaves us, puts us again back to dreams. And dreams, of course, have a meaning when we have a certain approach to human beings or a certain approach to soul. Then they get their meaning. I think to value dreams, and not just to consider them an irritant, you also have to value the fact or the concept or the idea, the fluffy idea, the flaky idea, which can't be really pinned down, the idea that maybe there's something around which could be soul, something mysterious, something not controllable, that's important, which always is here, but then it's not here again. Maybe there is something, a quality like that, which we can always only grasp in retrospective, not at a particular moment, but afterwards maybe we find something which has happened. And I think that's important in order then actually to value dreams. But now it's 10:30, so we have a break.
Pauses for a moment?
Yeah.
You comfortable staying with it during the...
No, it's okay.